Hi, everybody. This is Brett, and I want to tell you about a great company, wherecanibuystamps.info. You know, as a professional podcaster, I'm always sitting around with things to mail, and I say to myself, where can I buy stamps? You know, I'm sending demo tapes to radio stations to see if they'll put me on their station, and I don't have stamps, so I need a site that can tell me where I can buy them. Oh, here's another story about stamps. I used to get birthday cards from my grandma back in the 80s, and I would always look at the envelopes and say, geez, where did grandma get these stamps? Well, if I had wherecanibuystamps.info, I could have known up to 7 places where she might have bought them.
1 penny, 2 pennies, 3 pennies, 4 pennies, 5 pennies make a
nickel.
Hi, everyone. Do you like ads? Of course you don't. They're stupid. And even though School Sucks is a project that requires a lot of time and money, we're working hard to keep the show ad-free. You can help us by going to schoolsucksproject.com/AV and become a monthly subscriber. You'll get access to hundreds of hours of additional content, and it really, really helps the show. If enough people do it, it's like having sponsors, except you don't have to sit there and listen to me pretend to care about a ridiculous company like wherecanibuystamps.com. Are you kidding?
Let's go faster!
Thank you.
1 penny, 2 pennies, 3 pennies, 4 pennies, 5 pennies, make a
nickel.
6 pennies, 7 pennies, 8 pennies, 9 pennies, 10 pennies make a
dime.
2 dimes and a nickel make a
quarter.
Hi, everyone. Just in time for the holidays, School Sucks is pleased to present the story of liberal atheist Steve Shives and his unwavering faith in a power greater than himself. We begin today with a sermon from Steve.
Hey, here are 5 stupid things I've noticed about libertarianism. It's selfish. Libertarianism, like most political philosophies, is an old house with many rooms. For the purposes of this video, I'll be limiting myself to libertarianism as it is most commonly found in American politics today. Consequentialist, capitalist, and individualist in character. The defining characteristic of this form of libertarianism is selfishness. Libertarian thinkers and politicians, note the distinction, are capable of reciting some very impressive-sounding rhetoric about individual liberty and freedom of association, but it all reduces to this: I want to be left alone, and I want things my own way. Just think how many resentful 5-year-olds are libertarians without even realizing it. It alienates people from the government. Libertarians have all sorts of ominous-sounding ways of referring to the government: the beast, big brother, the state, with the S capitalized to look extra totalitarian. Most, if not all, libertarians view the government as the enemy of the people. It's written and spoken of as though it were some malevolent alien that has attached itself to our civilization, from whose tentacly clutches we must all constantly struggle to escape. But the thing is, a constitutional, democratically empowered government, like the one we have in the United States, doesn't have to be the enemy of the people. It can actually be the most powerful and effective tool of the people. Unfortunately, most politicians with libertarian leanings seem like they would rather sabotage the government than work to make it better and more effective, which is really shitty to those of us who agree with Abraham Lincoln on the whole of, by, and for the people thing. It's anachronistic. Most of the major expansions and reforms of government that libertarians resent and wish to dismantle, the Federal Reserve, Social Security, Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, etc., were brought about because there was a recognized need for them. Societies grow and evolve, and so do the needs and interests of their members. Even so, many libertarians often express a desire to roll things back to how they were once upon a time, in some cases all the way back to the day of the Founding Fathers. And this is perfectly understandable as I see it, because you would have to go back that far to find a point in American history where their ideas would have formed the basis of a sound political system rather than a failed and useless ideology. It puts on airs. I'm an atheist, and I know as well as anyone that we can be some condescending bastards when we want to be. But let me tell you something. When it comes to intolerable smugness, an atheist has got nothing on a libertarian. Unless the atheist in question happens to be a libertarian, which is not uncommon. Look, the point is this. Many libertarian politicians and commentators like to cultivate this image of intellectual superiority for themselves and their political philosophies. Unlike, say, liberals or non-libertarian conservatives, a libertarian roots his ideals firmly in the soil of reason. Libertarians are not swayed by appeals to emotions. They care not for what is popular or fashionable or empathetic or humane or fair or... Look, you get the idea. The point is, they're above all that. Which brings me to the last stupid thing I'll mention about libertarianism. It's naive. Yes, besides being outdated and buffoonishly pompous, libertarianism is also inescapably naive, since it assumes that, given maximum personal and economic freedom, individuals would just sort of work out an ideal or at least improved society for themselves. Never mind that democratic government represents an attempt to do exactly that sort of thing. Suppose not everyone in this minimally governed free market society was all that ethical. Suppose, and I know this is hard to imagine, but bear with me, that those with the most wealth and resources decided that their private interests were more important than those of other individuals or of society as a whole. Libertarians will often caricature government in exactly this way, describing it as the powerful living off of the powerless, with no concern for the welfare of those they exploit. And yet, the alternative that libertarians propose to this, which in their bitterness over having been born as members of a social species they perceive as tyranny at the hands of government, is something that amounts to tyranny at the hands of unaccountable magnates. Minimum government, maximum freedom, to those who can afford it. The hardest part is only picking five. Catch you next time. That's what faith can do. Doesn't matter what you've heard, impossible is not a word.
So Tony, welcome back to the show.
Hey Brad, thank you for having me back.
It's my pleasure. Look, I want to do a full disclosure. We have tried to do this show once before, and we both decided it didn't go very well.
The most entertaining aspect, I think, of our attempt was first, we both kind of rolled out of bed, I think, around the same time, right before we started the show. And I remember we're like, yeah, we're going to try to record video, I believe, as well as audio.
Yeah.
And I just remember my hair was standing up in every other direction. But I thought it'd be kind of entertaining to be like, hey, we talk about fallacies, but we're kind of mad scientists.
Right. Yeah. I remember it was like 3.5 hours into it. I raised the question, did we just totally get trolled by this guy that we're going to talk about on the show today? Because he is a troll. He goes trolling through YouTube and he brings back plenty in his net, I think, much to his delight. But one day we both found ourselves in that net.
Yeah, I mean, it's a perfect video to showcase how easy it is to use fallacies to kind of emotionally manipulate people, get people roused up and kind of excited or angry or aggressive to try to provide rebuttals, or even, I think, for himself just to get views. He just wanted, you know, hits on his channel or hits on these videos. And it's a classic sophist technique to get people interested in really nothing at all, because nothing is really being said in these videos. He's not making any cogent or coherent arguments. And that's kind of the point. You can tell he does this kind of on purpose to just get a rise out of people.
Sure. And, you know, when I first looked at this and thought about revisiting the Logic Saves Live series, it was my experience with this video that almost led to renaming it the Trivium Saves Lives, because I think a lot of what we're going to identify as logical errors are actually from, I guess, a lack of rigor on the part of Steve Shives with grammar, with definitions, and I think with understanding a lot of the history of what he's talking about.
Yeah, ironically, you know, we talk about logic, but logic's really getting into a sort of a methodology. But before you begin this sort of methodology to find truth, you have to be able to define what you're finding in the first place. And so what we're going to find is the first stage of the trivium general grammar. It's really that definition stage that we talked about in our previous podcast we had done together. Mm-hmm. And just the idea of defining your terms, knowing what universal concepts are, knowing what, you know, these fundamental aspects before you jump into then how do concepts relate to one another and how do you derive truth from relating concepts and terms and words to each other. That's really what logic deals with. And what you're going to see is he really doesn't define many of the things he talks about up front. And therefore, that can create a whole cascading effect, which happened with us last time, which is, you know, going into all these different historical contexts he didn't bring up and allowing ourselves to get kind of roused up about it, ironically. You know, that's kind of the point. Don't define it and just kind of bring up these simplistic fallacies to get people, you know, embedded in the nonsense of what he's saying. So,
yeah. And all that being said, I think some people in the audience might watch a video like this. And Steve Shibes is a liberal atheist. Now, he does do some good work. You know, he does do some deconstructions of Christian apologetics. He's certainly a smart guy. He's certainly entertaining. But when it comes to this topic of libertarianism, a lot of people might say, isn't this kind of low-hanging fruit for the Logic Saves Live series? Like, isn't this pretty easy work? This doesn't really require much heavy equipment for you guys to dig down and take this apart. I think that this video provides us a quick and entertaining way to look at some of the common objections to the philosophy of liberty, something we definitely should deal with in this series. But originally, we were going to go after Steve Shibes in a bigger way. He's got a lot of these five stupid things or anti-Ron Paul, anti-libertarian, anti-objectivist type videos. And we realized that just dealing with one because of what you talked about earlier is going to take a whole show. And people are going to get what Steve Shibes is all about. And they can go and investigate his work and take it apart for themselves after this if they desire.
Yeah, I think our original plan was to do what the five stupid things about libertarianism and then do the right after that in the same show, do the five stupid things about 9/11. And there's some other five stupid things about Ayn Rand. There's a couple other pretty entertaining ones he has. And the whole point of this series, again, I think he does it just to get hits on his YouTube channel just because he's being so blatantly obnoxious. But he also, you know, he carries that on his sleeve, if you will, just on his personality. That's kind of how he acts in many of his videos. He definitely has that sort of arrogant swagger to his disposition, which is, you know, what gives him character and makes his YouTube channel somewhat interesting, especially for topics he does a better job at actually arguing for, rather than just using fallacies to, you know, kind of get people emotionally invested into what he's saying.
Yeah.
And, you know, with logic, just real quickly, you mentioned, you know, dealing with liberty, and we're talking here about a method, the trivium method, and completely differentiated from the classical liberal education, the trivium. This is just we've hashed it out, I think, enough on this show and other places to know that what we're talking about is called the trivium method. Grammar, logic, and rhetoric, and starts with metaphysical context of reality existing and cause and effect. And really, you can look at Ayn Rand and objectivistic philosophy, objectivism, and see a similar pattern of philosophic thought. But with this method, we're dealing with cognitive liberty. And if we're not going to take it from the cognitive realm into the physical realm and the realm of action and reality, then, you know, we're only dealing with one half of the equation.
Right. Absolutely. And just to put this in the context of the trivium, I like Steve Shibes. I think he's entertaining and, you know, it's fine that he does this, but we already talked about what he's lacking in grammar. And I'm glad that you mentioned his presentation because it seems like there's an effort to make up for that, conscious or not, with the rhetoric that he does, right? He has this presentation, this authoritative style. People who disagree with me are silly. I mean, I think that's the thing you're supposed to get after just watching a couple of his videos.
Yeah, exactly. That's just his general disposition. He carries a sort of arrogant swagger about him. It radiates off his personality. I think obviously it's part of his show, and it's part of many of the productions he does. If you listen to him from a rhetorical standpoint, he's not using words like "I think" or "I believe," or he's not posing a question almost to himself, speaking out loud, which allows for the more dialectical style of discourse. He's just stating bluntly, "This is the way it is."
Right. I've also noticed that there is a lack of, for somebody so opinionated. And he is bright. There is a lack of debate videos on his YouTube channel. And people might say, well, Brett, you never have debates either. It's not like I haven't tried, you know, to find people who disagree with me, like especially people on the left. But I would think as far as liberty-minded people are concerned, they would be lining up to debate this guy. And I think it speaks to what the presentation of the channel is supposed to be, that there's an absence of dissenting views. Because if he's trying to produce entertaining content, I think debate can be some of the most entertaining content, especially with people who are coming from, you know, completely divergent points of view on a certain issue.
Yeah, I think that's generally the goal of his YouTube channel. Is he's not really interested in hashing out many of these ideas. This is just what he believes and what he wants to expose about himself or ideas. So he doesn't really care about, I hate to say it this way, but ascertaining truth. It's quite obvious that he's made up his mind about many of these topics. You know, oftentimes atheists have a sort of smug attitude because they try to argue from evidence and reason. However, ironically, and Stefan Molyneux does a good job of pointing this out, that atheists tend to replace God with the state, and he calls himself a liberal atheist. Ironically, he's then calling for a sort of supra-conceptual abstract idea that we still need some sort of governing authority over us. You know, it's not God anymore, but it'll be the state. And I think that was a beautiful insight from Stefan about, you know, if you were going to follow evidence and reason through and the non-aggression principle and reality existing, so forth and so on, it also gets to the idea that the state itself is nothing but an abstraction of violence and coercion. And if we're going to follow our logic consistently through, you know, if atheists will argue from evidence and reason, we got to argue from evidence and reason about what the state actually is and has been in history and what it really is. And just boils down to just generally violence. Mm-hmm. And so if, like, we talk about cognitive liberty, we're talking about the entire realm of liberty here, not just a free mind, but a free body, soul, spirit, or the whole complex of what it means to be human. And that doesn't just mean the mind. That means just our ability to engage with other human beings in peaceful ways without having some sort of authoritarian structure over us that's going to mediate the way we do that.
Absolutely. Well said. So the way this is going to work is it's five stupid things about libertarianism. We are going to take them one by one, because if you take all five at the same time, it can become a little overwhelming and a little confusing. And you're going to see why as the video plays out. But I first watched it, I think, with my guard down. And I mentioned this to you earlier. I watched it and it ended and I said, am I an idiot? This doesn't make any sense to me at all. Have I completely missed what libertarianism really is? You know, just that kind of quiet question before all of the knowledge comes flooding in to counter each one of his five points about the stupidness of libertarianism. But I was left there for a minute like, does this guy really know what he's talking about? Because the way he builds the video is actually quite clever. Even the building he does within each of his five stupid things, if you don't pay attention to what's happening, I think there's a lot of people out in his audience who were convinced by this video. And I felt like there was an urgency
well
in
said.
Dealing with it.
I'm sorry to cut in there, but that's just so well said. Yeah, convinced just by the way he presents himself. He creates a sort of perceptual trick of this authoritarian disposition that's speaking almost down to libertarianism as how could you ever possibly believe this? Which we can get into what type of fallacy that would be. But just he radiates with that, just the way he uses language. He speaks with such directness. If you don't have your guard up, it's very easy to allow his conclusions to permeate the mind, and all of a sudden you kind of get lost. Well, what was I thinking? Well, what is, maybe he has a point here, just because of the way he speaks so directly about these issues. He doesn't say I believe or I think, as I mentioned before. He's speaking directly with a sort of smugness and arrogance that many sophists utilize, especially with some of the techniques, other rhetorical techniques we'll get into that are fallacies, to really emotionally manipulate us on a subconscious level.
Yeah. And just to jump back to what I said a minute ago, I don't want people in the audience like worried, does Brett really think he's an idiot and that libertarianism is stupid sometimes? No, this happened. This was like 15 seconds for me after I finished watching the video, and I was just baffled by the experience I just had. But for many people who view this video, and this video, the views are in the tens of thousands, that continues for much longer than 15 seconds, and that's really unfortunate. And I want to try and help those people with today's show. So are you ready to begin?
Let's do it.
All right. This is number one.
It's selfish. Libertarianism, like most political philosophies, is an old house with many rooms. For the purposes of this video, I'll be limiting myself to libertarianism as it is most commonly found in American politics today. Consequentialist, capitalist, and individualist in character. The defining characteristic of this form of libertarianism is selfishness. Libertarian thinkers and politicians, note the distinction, are capable of reciting some very impressive sounding rhetoric about individual liberty and freedom of association, but it all reduces to this: I want to be left alone, and I want things my own way. Just think how many resentful 5-year-olds are libertarians without even realizing it.
Okay. Interesting foreshadow, I would say. In this video, I'll be limiting myself. He certainly will, and I think limiting the rest of us as well. So number one is, it's selfish. What are your thoughts after hearing that?
Well, first of all, the word definition comes from the Latin defino, which means to put limits on. So in a way, what he's doing here is creating his own pseudo-definition. This isn't a real definition, but a pseudo-definition of what he believes is part the properties that make up libertarianism. And so he's limiting himself to what he calls consequentialism, I believe, capitalism. These are kind of the properties. If we need to come back at any time, which I'm sure we will, to, well, what's he talking about anymore? What was the definition of, you know, like the idea of just define your terms in an argument? We kind of have to come back to this. As we go on, we'll see even his definition is sort of incorrect. It's a modern day false interpretation, if you will, of what capitalism is. What consequentialism is, and is what we're going to need to focus on. This pseudo definition is the domino effect for the rest of the five stupid things.
The other
one, I just wanted to bring that point up first. As far as the selfishness, I believe that's what you mentioned. That's an irrelevant conclusion based on the premises in the chain here, because he's stating the idea that because they tout sophisticated rhetoric like individualism, I see it as an irrelevant conclusion. Having an individualistic spirit or believing in individual liberties is inherently selfish. Those two don't necessarily follow from each other. We can also call it a fallacy of a false association, where we're relating two variables, two concepts together that really don't have any relation. They might have correlative properties. They might relate to each other in ways that don't necessarily affect one another, but we can see similar trends. That doesn't mean that when one happens, the other happens as a sort of cause and effect.
Right.
And being an individual, as an example, if I have an individualistic spirit and I want to go out and help someone, and I have that individual liberty or will to do so, is that me being selfish in a free society, in a free market analysis, working for a small business when we give to charity? That's out of our own individual free will, you know? So it's this kind of, and those are super simple examples of that show that having individualistic will or having a will for yourself doesn't necessarily mean you're going to be inherently selfish. But then again, how is he going to define selfish?
Right, right. So just to reiterate some of the things you said and then broaden a little bit. Yes, the most important thing in debate or rhetoric, I would say, or one of the most important things is proper definition and identification. And a super easy way to win a debate is to define things however you want and get away with it. And then because of that initial misidentification, we can see an interesting thing happen. I remember this thing. We talked about this in the productivity series, and I use this example from Tony Robbins having a golf lesson. And, you know, he was shanking it into the woods, he felt, and his instructor said, oh, you're actually just a millimeter off, you know, at the beginning, at where you address the ball with the head of your club. Like, 1 or 2 millimeters in either direction at the beginning can make a big difference in where, like 30, 40, 50, 60 yards difference in where you end up. So just by massaging definitions at the beginning, he can really take this way, way off course in the end. And it also allows for this rhetorical strategy. I would call it hedging. I don't know if it actually has a name. Using words with ambiguous meanings, you know, being unclear with definitions, and that allows you the flexibility to change the meaning of them later if it's necessary.
That's actually that's a brilliant point. There's a fallacy associated with that called amphiboly.
Yes.
It's a fallacy of language. And when we use fallacies, just for the audience out there, it's best to try to break it down and categorize it into a couple different categories. It helps the mind just be able to more quickly reference what fallacy you might be hearing or reading at the time. So yeah, there's fallacies of language, fallacies of diversion, fallacies of argumentation, oversimplification. You can use any number of methods to kind of group a bunch of fallacies under a general category, and that just helps you for reference purposes. Just helps your mind be able to associate what fallacy might be applied to a phrase or sentence you're hearing or someone saying or something you might be reading. So I just wanted to give that to the audience. And to go back to the idea of what you're talking about, these ambiguous words or phrases, this is actually a fallacy called amphiboly, which is it's not necessarily an ambiguous word. That would be more equivocation, but it's an ambiguous syntax, puns. But it crosses over a bit with equivocation. But I would call this one amphiboly because he's not necessarily using libertarianism in two different places and defining him differently. Well, he might be actually, now that I think about it. And we'll have to go on to see. But either way, both fallacies I'm mentioning here are fallacies of language. Equivocation, which is using the same term and having multiple definitions for it, or amphiboly, which is an ambiguous syntax or word grouping or phrase. Depending on the context and the way he uses it, begins this sort of cascading or domino effect of all the fallacies we're going to kind of go into later on, because he didn't properly really define libertarianism. So this definition's very ambiguous and loose, and we're going to see he's going to switch up the properties of this supposed definition he gave by the limited definition we talked about all over the place, which is really in a way equivocation because he's using libertarianism all over the place, but he's applying different properties to it, oftentimes that are contradicting each other.
There's also an important distinction that he doesn't make between what he considers to be libertarian politicians, which is really like most of his talking seems to be directed towards what he conceives to be a libertarian politician in the 21st century, which could be expanded all the way out to include Ted Cruz, you know, certainly Rand Paul. And he's not making a distinction between people like that and libertarian thinkers, the philosophers, the Rothbards, right? So yeah, that makes things super, super messy. But there's another language fallacy, or I would actually call it basically doublespeak. And it's either very clever or it is accidental with a beneficial outcome for him, for most people who view the video, and that's using a euphemism for government. And I think he'll do this several times throughout the video. He just kind of hinted at it here, using words like social, right? Like being social, and libertarianism is anti-social, right? Anti-government is anti-social. Now, that allows for the irrelevant conclusion that you mentioned, but it also leads to this another type of fallacy, false dilemma, false dichotomy, or the black and white fallacy.
Black and white.
Yeah. Two alternative statements that are held to be the only possible options when in reality there are a lot more. That is accomplished by his manipulation of the language right out of the gate.
The other way to look at what you just stated is this also could be called a dicto simpliciter, which is just a fallacy of oversimplification, applying a general principle to just a special case without qualifying it at all, defining it at all, these sorts of ideas. In this case, he's relating this idea of being a part of society and government together, and he's oversimplifying the two, really, what government is, what society is, and how the both interrelate. And that creates, obviously, the fallacy you just mentioned, the black and white fallacy or the either-or fallacy. It also creates irrelevant conclusions. And other fallacies are actually fallacies of argumentation. And fallacies of argumentation would just be the fact that you have your premises set up and you try to relate your premises to the conclusion, and it just isn't following because he's oversimplifying certain concepts that are making cases like, well, it's either this, you're either selfish or you're part of society, which is also part of the government.
Yeah.
Somehow.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
He also gets to do a really, as far as his presentation is concerned, a very valuable exclusion, right? When he talks about defining characteristics, he says, I'm limiting myself to libertarianism as it is presently found in politics today. Now, it's nice that he admits that, you know, I think that is good that he actually clarifies that. But the video is called Five Stupid Things About Libertarianism, period, which I think is misleading. He talks about consequentialism as being a characteristic of libertarianism, which erases a huge ongoing debate within libertarianism today, and then capitalism and individualism. But then he says the defining characteristic is selfishness. So how convenient. Now you don't have to talk about property rights and somehow deconstruct that. You don't have to talk about self-ownership and somehow deconstruct that. You don't have to talk about the non-aggression principle and somehow deconstruct that. So he's really paved a nice, easy street for himself with number one before he goes on to the next four.
Yeah, he just skipped over the philosophical debates and implications that derived the concept of libertarianism in the first place, and are really, quite frankly, the foundations of all philosophical discourse. And the idea of the non-aggression principle or property rights, self-liberty, self-ownership, these come from deeply debated and highly abstracted scenarios from philosophers trying to find a progression to the way we can be a part of a more peaceful society, how we can create more peaceful relations with one another without having so much force and violence and subordination.
That was thorough enough for number one, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we could go on and on like we did the last time, but I think that covers generally how you can apply all these different fallacies of language, fallacies of argumentation, how you can oversimplify and all these different concepts. So people, if you want to dig in further, just get a fallacy list. You can just search fallacies online anywhere, and you can try to pick apart more and see how deep this can go. Because once you find one or two fallacies, you can find that there's a lot more that follows. And like I said, once you find that out, the best thing to do is once you've realized that someone's using language fallaciously, the next question to ask is, are they doing it intentionally or is it just an honest mistake of the individual? In this case, I think it's a bit more intentional, but that's just my interpretation. Nonetheless, that's the next question, in my opinion, to ask. And that allows you to say, well, if this guy or this person, this woman, this man uses this in a context that I don't believe they're being inherently dishonest, then you can continue on with the whatever arguments they might be making. But if they're using it intentionally dishonest, then you know to be very careful moving forward with how they then present language and arguments.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, this could just be what's that called? The Dunning-Kruger effect, right?
Oh, right. Yeah.
Right. It's a cognitive bias when people suffer from a kind of illusory superiority, right? Doing kind of the opposite of what Socrates advised. It'd be more like believing that I know everything, I actually know nothing.
It really is the opposite of Socrates. Knowing that I know nothing or knowing that I know everything.
Right.
It does make for entertaining discourse, I'll tell you that.
Right. All right. And for those who might not have gotten that really good joke that just happened, Socrates said, in knowing that I know nothing, that makes me the wisest of all. Something paraphrase.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Number two, it alienates people from the government. Libertarianism does. Here we go.
It alienates people from the government. Libertarians have all sorts of ominous sounding ways of referring to the government, the beast, big brother, the state with the S capitalized to look extra totalitarian. Most, if not all, libertarians view the government as the enemy of the people. It's written and spoken of as though it were some malevolent alien that has attached itself to our civilization, from whose tentacly clutches we must all constantly struggle to escape. But the thing is, a constitutional, democratically empowered government, like the one we have in the United States, doesn't have to be the enemy of the people. It can actually be the most powerful and effective tool of the people. Unfortunately, most politicians with libertarian leanings seem like they would rather sabotage the government than work to make it better and more effective, which is really shitty to those of us who agree with Abraham Lincoln on the whole of, by, and for the people thing.
Okay, so things are quickly spiraling out of control here already at number two.
Just a little bit.
Yeah. Now, first of all, I think it's interesting that he leads off number two, accusing libertarians of exactly what he spent all of number one doing, which is basically crafting convenient definitions for things that create biases in people before the argument even begins, right?
Right. Or kind of well, the way he crafts definitions, which is actually another fallacy of the language called tu quoque, which literally translates as you too.
Yeah, absolutely. So the whole idea, libertarianism alienates people from the government. We also see he slips this in, right? Politicians with libertarian leanings. So that goes to what I said before, this ever-expanding, conveniently for him, ever-expanding definition of what libertarianism is. Now he can use examples of this nebulous politicians with libertarian leanings, right? Which gives him a bigger pool to pull from for criticism.
And again, this goes back to the idea of the ambiguous nature of the way he uses libertarianism. So in this case, it's really an equivocation on a libertarianism. And as we stated in the beginning, he's going to apply different properties and associations with libertarianism to mold or direct the way he wants to portray what he believes is modern day libertarianism.
Right. Yeah.
And again, you know, going back to when we first, we're getting back into the idea of the trivium, the general grammar stage, and we don't have a consistent definition, which requires us to, you know, analyze a universal principle, which he's not doing here. There's no real universal principle he's applying that seems to be consistent across scale, if you will, about what libertarianism actually deals with, because he doesn't get into the philosophy of libertarianism. He's getting into sort of the modern day mass media interpretation and either vilification or apotheosis, depending on viewpoint, of certain figures that define themselves in modern day rhetoric and politics as libertarian, which is very starkly different from the philosophy underlying and the conceptual ideas underlying what libertarian actually is.
Yeah. Now, it being libertarianism, alienating people from the government, there's things I'd like to see fleshed out a little bit better there as well. Government could use a definition, right? Because alienating people from the government, as a libertarian, I don't feel that way at all. I think it's actually kind of this opposite effect. Like, first of all, the government is people. The state is, as Larkin Rose says, a dangerous superstition. It's another religion from which we, like Steve Shives with a lot of his atheism work, are trying to free people. So to make this dichotomy, I think, is also very deceiving. I think what most libertarians say is, no, wait, the government is just people, you know, and it's this superstition that we have to deal with. I think that libertarianism might alienate people from the government in a very sort of vague way, but it's missing this idea that the opposite political ideology or a far away political ideology is connecting people to this superstition of government in a way that they shouldn't be, in a way that is just as dangerous as some religion has been historically.
Yeah, the superstition is really just a thought form or idea that really is manifested in the actions of human beings, because it's nothing more than an abstraction. In other words, it's nothing more than an idea that exists in the minds of human beings that actually molds and shapes the way in which we behave under this sort of superstition, belief, or abstraction, which are all interrelated. In this case, because if you look at what government is, and government, ironically, is just made up of other human beings. If you deconstruct, if you will, and I hate to borrow that postmodern term, but if you deconstruct what it actually is, it's made up of nothing but people. Functioning to provide supposed benefits and to, you know, enforce contract law and a whole bunch of other stuff, but it's just people.
Yeah.
You know, it's people interacting with other people, which makes it very nebulous and a sort of amorphous object that it's always changing depending on how people interact with it or how it's interacting with you. And so I would say this is sort of it's a non sequitur. The fact that he says, you know, there is this government and it's alienating people from this thing called government. Well, I don't see how that follows from the fact of what government actually is.
Right.
And that's a fallacy of argumentation because I'm breaking it up into premises. I'm kind of breaking his argument down more simply into what he's calling government and then what he thinks is this alienation to this great, great thing, this great abstraction. What government is doesn't mean you're necessarily alienated from it if you're a libertarian.
Right.
And that's a problem. Libertarians, if I were to go by the mass media definition, and this is my interpretation of the mass media definition, libertarians oftentimes believe in some form of government, some form of a public realm that provides maybe a service of arms and protection. But they want a very limited form of government. It's like a sort of form of neoconservatism. If you will. That's how I often, at least from my perception and interpretation, how the mass media portrays it. Actual libertarian philosophy, look at like Bastiat, Rothbard, Mises, et al., you know, the whole Austrian school of economics, which really helped to provide the philosophical underpinning, or at least the economical structure, which really is based on philosophy. Of what libertarian actually is and how it can be manifested. It's completely different. It really is completely different because they get into the idea of some of the more foundational ideas. What is force? What is violence? Is it right to actually enforce or use other people in a public realm to enforce certain universal constituents between individuals? And they try to tailor it down to the actual philosophical implications of what government is, try to define these terms from these abstract interactions with these ideas into actually what it seems to be on a universal level.
Right.
And what government is universally. And as I mentioned earlier, you know, if you really start to get into it, it tends to break down into violence, coercion, because it's essentially you're apotheosizing or adorning a certain group of people with the right. The certain privilege or badge, if you will, metaphorically speaking, that they can enforce certain rights universally across scales to other individuals and groups and people, so forth and so on. But again, notice the words I'm using. I'm using the word force. I should use violence because you're actually then violating sort of the individual rights that are inherent by the fact that we live in reality and cause and effect. If people aren't following me here, just understand that this is how deep it goes. You know, this is how much great philosophers and thinkers have really thought about these issues and how much it's just not the simple portrayal of the media or how Steve Shives is really defining it in this context.
Right. And it's important that you mention that, too, because he's also revealing his own philosophical underpinnings here. I don't want to call him a background because I don't know how much scholarship he actually has done, you know, and in his defense, it's a 5-minute video. So we can't say, all right, well, you know, here are the biases that I have, or here's the research that I've done that color my view of this topic. I understand there's not a place for that in this video, but it's implied here, this idea that we should be connected to the government, whatever it is, that we have a duty or responsibility to society that libertarians are dodging, right? So there's a lot of philosophy there. Now, where that came from, what he's read, I really don't have any knowledge of that.
He's also wrong from a historical standpoint. The founding fathers viewed government as an evil necessity, something that unfortunately was a required evil, if you will. They recognized that it always seems to become more powerful than it always intends to be, and that's something to be mitigated or mediated in some fashion or completely mistrusted. It's just interesting that he now thinks that we should be in some way what we have a duty to this idea of what government is. I just think of, you know, the ideas that have been presented in the 20th century about what democracy actually is, which is a form of statism, the form of a citizen or a citizenship, that you have a sort of duty to this, again, this general abstraction that really changes definition based on how you want people to be subordinated to it and act underneath it. And that's just, when you look at it from a historical standpoint, it just doesn't even hold up because the idea of duty, now we're not talking about Kant's moral ethics here or moral philosophy where there's a duty. based on, you know, these categories. This is completely different. He's talking simply that where there's a duty here to this God, you know, this abstraction that is made up of nothing but other individuals and people. And we oftentimes, unfortunately, in history, Western history is really just overcoming this idea or this it's essentially a history of property rights and a history of individual rights, trying to find ways to set up mediating factors between the king and the feudal class, or even the aristocrats and the merchants. And it's just coming more and more into an individualistic mindset. And that's the history of Western government. And he's ignoring so much history here, it becomes overwhelming. And we can analyze that in another podcast if really wanted to.
Sure.
I think it's important to mention that there's a lot of neglected aspect here and missing context or completely irrelevant context.
Simply put, you know, now Steve Shives prides himself as being a fighter against dangerous superstitions. Right. But when this dangerous superstition of government is in place, when it is accepted by most people, you don't have to worry about whatever this alienating people from the government means. People are alienated from people. Right. Different groups are created where some people can be thieves and killers and predators against other people. Right. So there's a lot more dangers there in alienation that aren't being addressed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's right. Again, looking at the history of Western history, it's just it's finding ways that we can interact with each other more peacefully without violence and warfare and all these other problems that have plagued, unfortunately, all of human history. And just the idea that if we give more and more rights to individuals, there seems to be less and less violence. We can call it a correlation causation, but there's certainly something there that he's just neglecting to look at.
Right. You know, I got hung up the first time when we were listening to number two on this glaring error, him criticizing libertarians for exactly the same thing that we pointed out he's doing in number one. I just want to replay it since it's only about a minute to see if there's anything else we should try to take away from this before we move on to number three.
Libertarians have all sorts of ominous sounding ways of referring to the government, the beast, big brother, the state with the S capitalized to look extra totalitarian. Most, if not all, libertarians view the government as the enemy of the people. It's written and spoken of as though it were some malevolent alien that has attached itself to our civilization, from whose tentacly clutches we must all constantly struggle to escape. But the thing is, a constitutional, democratically empowered government, like the one we have in the United States.
Okay. A constitutional, democratically empowered government like the one we have in the United States.
Constitutional and democratic government, that's all contradictory. All those different concepts represent different universal aspects to what makes them their own ideas.
I'm not ashamed of what happened to us the last time we tried to do this show at all, because what he just said, we could do a whole series about, right?
Right.
A whole historical series about the power being taken away from the Constitution and really concentrated into the hands of the executive branch of the federal government. Right. Going back, I mean, you could take it back to Lincoln, but you can really, really see that concentration.
The 14th Amendment, the Articles, I mean, before even the, you know, the ratified Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, the different arguments for how we should actually set up a government. I mean, God, there's just so much missing here.
But I would really put most of that on FDR and the alphabet agencies as far as, you know, the shift in power to bureaucracies. And disregard for the Constitution that has obviously continued since then. I wouldn't even say that it's necessarily accelerated since FDR, because I think that would have been a pretty startling period for people like you or me to live through in history.
From a social or societal standpoint, it actually was, and many people, many poor individuals, the people that are really affected by the Great Depression, very much vehemently opposed many of these alphabet soup programs that were being perpetuated and created by the government. because they, from a familial aspect, they came over to have the will to actually try to make it themselves. And all of a sudden now the government is imposing ways for them to get jobs and to have a sort of identity for themselves that they wanted to create for themselves. The government's doing it. In a way, it's replacing your own self-will. And that was from a societal standpoint, that was a major issue that oftentimes really is neglected from schooling. It's actually something I learned in high school, ironically, because I had a very conservative teacher that said, you know, and being, of course, in high school, very liberal at the time, because they got me when I was young, just this idea, of course, it just works out better if you just let the government do everything. But I was so shocked to hear that. How could individuals be so opposed to the government helping them out when, in fact, there was a major opposition, especially amongst the people that are really affected most by the Great Depression?
Yeah, another huge context that's omitted, right? Why would people oppose this? This is great. You know, well, I think then, just to launch your exploration into this, why do people want this kind of system? Do they want to just high-five me as I pass them on the road to prosperity? Is that their goal with all these social programs? Or do they want to treat me like one of their pets? And the 20th century told that story all too well. You know, it's interesting when you talked about people coming here. I just pictured somebody, you know, from Italy or Germany specifically showing up here in like 1936, having only ever experienced America through a series of myths, and getting off the boat and saying, well, shit. You know, like picking up a newspaper. And I mean, now, obviously, as the next 10 years play out, yes, they were better off in America than they would have been in Italy or Germany. You know, obviously, right. You know, having an ocean between you and all the fighting was to the benefit of many immigrants.
The fighting didn't take place on American soil alone would be enough reason to be in America. But
right. OK, so this is just the rest of number two. Let's see if we catch anything else.
Wanted to bring up something real quick.
Sure.
He uses these incredibly imaginative metaphors and analogies to describe what government is, which ultimately reinforces this perception, this definition based really on mass media interpretation, what libertarians perceive government as being, that reinforces fallacies of argumentation like the either-or fallacy or the black-and-white fallacy, creates non-sequiturs, it creates oversimplifications, so forth and so on.
Right.
And, you know, it's just important to recognize that when he uses rhetoric in a way to create these incredibly imaginative imagery of this alien with tentacles reaching out and inundating you with its, like, being and forcing you under its will, blah, 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 that it emotionally will kind of incense us and enrage us a little bit, whether we're for or against what he's saying. Subconsciously, analyze what you might be feeling when he starts to present language in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. So we got about 30 seconds left here in our replay of number two. If we don't catch anything else, we'll move on to number three.
Doesn't have to be the enemy of the people. It can actually be the most powerful and effective tool of the people.
I would have liked two examples there. You know, that would have helped.
Do you get a feeling that he assumes that the government should be doing, like, because the idea that the government should act in the negative, that it should only be there as a last resort, sort of the real basic idea of what the founding fathers set this up as, or this idea that now the government's this prescriptive force. It prescribes not only rights, but the way human beings should act, called social engineering and other things. I just get this feeling that, you know, he's not just using it that it should be there as a last resort, that it should be there just empowering. And, you know, you go to the government to try to change the law or get more laws in place so you can, you know, and change the way people act, the interact with, you know, different groups or products or philosophy, whatever. I just get the feeling that it's not in the apathetic, it's not in the negative anymore. It's this idea of prescriptive ideations. In other words, like the government, we go to he thinks that we should go to the government and force them to create more laws for things that might be unjust so they can use more violence to force more people to do more things that might be against their own individual will.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot to that, to what he just said, as far as where that comes from. I would put some of the blame on the schooling system, which limits for a lot of people a kind of creative individualistic thinking, like how would these problems be solved if, let's just say, this institution wasn't there, right? So there's kind of a priori.
Good point. You know, government already exists as a fundamental thing before you begin your reason.
Right. The other part of that, too, is just the way the whole milieu of school works, right? We're basically told that, hey, welcome to the system. It was here before you got here. It's functioning just fine. Your input at the appropriate times will be treated as if it has maybe some value. You can fill out these little papers that we give you once a year. That's about it, actually. That's about
it's
all
it's like a lack of creativity. It's really the allegory of the cave in that regard, right?
Yeah, well,
go ahead.
You know, the idea that this system is already moving along when you got here, right? So if you don't have something better, you know, if you're going to criticize a system, you need a similar but better system ready to put in its place. You can't just be critical. This was one of the great lessons of a book school critic John Cazole wrote called The Night is Dark and I'm Far From Home. You are invited, if you're polite, to be a participant in what's already happening. But the change that you can make in what's already happening is limited to, you know, one of two political parties once a year, once every 2 years, once every 4 years, once every 6 years, depending on what we're talking about. And that's it.
Yeah, that's a good point. You know, I see this a lot in alternative media, even with podcasts, not such as yours, but, you know, just all over the alternative media spectrum, where people, when we analyze a problem or, you know, critique a system or a failed policy or governmental action or whatever it would be, people want an instant solution, where sometimes the solution isn't immediately had or available. In other words, you really can't come to a solution until we've really provided a full critique of the problem, you know, and try to deconstruct it to its foundational or fundamental roots as to where it became sick in the first place, if you will.
Right.
And I think it's important to, and I also think it's natural, being human, that we would want a solution in place, especially when we hear something that might be emotionally volatile, something that might be very, you know, disconcerting to our being when we first hear something that might not, we might not or want to believe exists.
Mm-hmm. So. You ready to move on to number three?
Go for it.
All right, number three, it's anachronistic.
It's anachronistic. Most of the major expansions and reforms of government that libertarians resent and wish to dismantle, the Federal Reserve, Social Security, Medicare, the Civil Rights Act, the Americans with Disabilities Act, etc., were brought about because there was a recognized need for them. Societies grow and evolve, and so do the needs and interests of their members. Even so, many libertarians often express a desire to roll things back to how they were once upon a time, in some cases all the way back to the day of the founding fathers. And this is perfectly understandable, as I see it, because you would have to go back that far to find a point in American history where their ideas would have formed the basis of a sound political system rather than a failed and useless ideology.
Now, first of all,
there's so much here. It's hard to know where to begin, but go ahead.
Just for those who might be unfamiliar with the term, an anachronism is basically out of place in time, right? So if you see...
Yeah, right.
Anachronisms are common in movies that are like take place in the 1960s and the 1970s. Sometimes when they're gathering all the props, there will be, say, a car that was made in 1972 when the movie takes place in 1970. This has actually happened to one of my favorite filmmakers, Martin Scorsese. There's a car in the movie Goodfellas.
Really?
Yep. Parts of the movie take place in 1970. There's a car that was made in like 1973.
Wait, which movie?
Goodfellas.
Goodfellas? Okay,
yeah.
I thought, okay.
And then there was a scene in Raging Bull, which was actually made 10 years before Goodfellas, where they had to reshoot a part, according to legend. Martin Scorsese demanded a scene be reshot because a guy in the fourth row at a boxing match had a watch on that wasn't period. So, yeah.
It's similar to Stanley Kubrick and his attention to detail.
Yes.
Stanley Kubrick was obsessed with detail. So much so that people are interested in just a little half-hour documentary of just how far some of the greatest artists, especially in the media realm, have gone. You can take a look at, I think it's called Stanley Kubrick's, oh, God, I'm forgetting. It's like Files or Stanley Kubrick's records are it's a half hour documentary just about how he collected millions and millions and millions of documents and files all perfectly organized because he wanted to avoid these errors you're mentioning now. Very, yeah. Very interesting.
So
how some of the greatest artists in history have really been so detailed, obsessively so.
So those who lack that attention to detail, their films might contain anachronisms, right? So he is saying that libertarianism is anachronistic. Well, one fallacy that's happening here is something called the appeal to novelty, when he makes the argument that libertarianism is bad because it's old, especially when compared to the blessings of the state in the 20th century. The principle said that things that are old are not preferable to things that are newer. But then suddenly, it's what fallacy? Then the whole thing becomes the stolen concept fallacy, right? Because government is older than libertarianism, so his principle fails.
Yeah, exactly. The idea that you're using a concept to refute other concepts, but then using it back to embolden your own argument.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of distilling these ideas and trying to use these ideas to refute some other idea, but then using the same idea to bolster another argument you're making. It was actually devised by Ayn Rand, I believe, was the one who came up with this idea. Because rationalists oftentimes, or people who took extreme rationalistic tendencies, tried to explain away reality. And in explaining reality, you have to use the concept of reality itself. And so that's kind of where, or cause and effect, or just the idea that we exist. To explain away existence, you have to already be existing. And that's sort of, it's not a paradox.
Yeah.
It's a contradiction. And it was, it's really used in the philosophical realm amongst philosophers who argue in metaphysics, which is just the question of what is, big word for the question, what is. But in this case, it applies in the way he's using government and using historical precedents, such as government, and saying that libertarianism is anachronistic, but government somehow is not. You know, really? And what, to me, I'm sure there's a fallacy that goes with this, but it just represents that we're not defining much here. We're not stating something that's universal to these concepts. So to libertarianism, there's nothing universal. There's nothing that survives time. This is not some sort of amorphous object that changes, or some sort of quantum paradox. You look at it changes its position or its quality or whatever. This is not that. There's some, when we talked about in the first podcast, the idea that our mind separates out what makes something unique versus what makes something alike. And those qualities are what allow us to identify things that are actually universal about the ideas, the concepts that we come up with and use to communicate through words and interact with other people in life. So there has to be at least some universal concept to government that has existed and has continued to exist prior to not just a couple of centuries ago, but now for millennia and millennia. The same with the ideas that have derived the concept of libertarianism. There's something universal. There's something truly unique that survives, that crosses scales, if you will. It's not just sort of an anachronism, sort of just something in context, a term that existed back here that had this conceptual meaning, but now is completely different based in this time period.
Right.
That's completely. So to me, before we can analyze a bunch of fallacies here, and we will, but I just think we're getting back to this idea that we talked about essence in Aristotelian logic. And he's just, in essence, relates to definition. If we're not going to state something that's truly universal and unique, that can be one thing that's sayable about many things. What makes a tree is a concept. We can look at all the individual trees, but why in our head, if I say tree, someone else can at least picture and come to the same general idea of what a tree is. It's the same idea with these other concepts we're presenting here. Government, libertarianism, liberty, freedom, selfishness. All these things have certain qualities that make them truly unique and go across time scales or terminology or definitional scales. This is the whole point of the trivium, the first stage, general grammar, and that's why definition is so important. I believe in medieval debate, definition was taken to a whole another level where
in a way, you had to restate your opponent's argument in your own words to make sure there was no equivocation or ambiguous nature to the concepts that were being presented in the argument.
Yeah.
So you just couldn't sit there and restate literally the argument. You had to present it in your own words first. And this presented all of the fallacies we're being able to derive from the fact that he's being ambiguous all over the place with the way he's presenting this video.
Right. So by this same definition problem that you just mentioned that we talked about in the number one example in this video, we see it rearing its ugly head here again, because he doesn't have to mention now that just libertarianism is fucking whatever, man. You know, he doesn't have to mention that as a political movement, it goes back in the United States to the early 70s. He doesn't have to mention that maybe you could trace it back a little bit further to some of Rand's conclusions decades earlier, with respect really to the fourth branch of philosophy being politics. He doesn't have to address that you can maybe even trace it back to Spooner if you want at the end of the 19th century, or that you could go as far back if you want to discourse on involuntary servitude, right? Or the Anti-Dictator by Labatier in the mid-1500s. But even then, it's still like...
That's a great reference. Great reference, yeah. That's absolutely correct. Because what are we analyzing here? But universal concepts that relate to some of the ideas that libertarian philosophers have used to create the idea of libertarianism in the first place. So there's these concepts that across timescales are consistent. They represent something truly unique and universal that we're trying to get at, the idea of liberty, first and foremost, you know, the idea of a self-will, your own individual deterministic will, and freedom from despotism, freedom from monarchy, freedom from, you know, overt government control. And these all have universal constituents or characteristics that are consistent across time.
Yeah. But even if you trace it back to those early formulations, right, it's still the concept of libertarianism is still, as far as the writing is concerned, is still like 5,000 years newer than the state. So his whole argument falls apart right there. And if it wasn't for fallacies, number three in this video wouldn't exist.
And the whole reason why it can go back that far is because some of the universal concepts that make up the properties that we define as libertarianism today, just the colloquial usage, just the nominal usage, this word, this name, libertarianism, has similar universal properties and concepts that have been argued about in all of human history and presented under different nomina or different names, but still have concepts underneath them that represent universal concepts, universal ideals that people have recognized in their own time, freedoms, slavery, individual rights, the property rights, these sorts of wars and whole political movements and whole disassociations of and destabilizations of monarchies and the beginning of even the nation state and other ideas of how to restructure came from.
Right.
So it's just here's a fallacy, is a neglected aspect of human history.
Yeah.
The inability to define, which is, we can get into a whole number of fallacies here. I mean, non sequiturs, neglected aspects. So it's also the fallacy of post hoc ergo propter hoc, which just means after that, therefore caused by that. Yeah, like I think what he's doing here is, because libertarian as a concept happens and exists right now, it was caused by ideas from the past that have no relationship to things that happen now.
Well, I think what it boils down to go back to neglect, like everything that you just mentioned, that history, that investigation, that philosophy, is all neglected, because when he's doing number three in this video, he's only picturing a Tea Party rally that he drove by on his way to Starbucks, because that's what's convenient. Right. That's what's convenient to say, because those are the people who say, let's take America back, or let's return to the way things were, or Constitution, founding fathers, tri-cornered hats. You know, that's what he's picturing. So that picture in his mind allows him to neglect everything you just mentioned.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. It creates irrelevant conclusions. You know, he's pretty much refuting himself by some of the conclusions, by his perception of what libertarian actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, you know, just missing the point, if you will, because he hasn't really, again, defined what it is. So.
Right. Yeah. And that was the question that I asked, I think, when I first or second time I watched the video, where is he getting this idea? you know? And I really tried to understand that. I mean, that's what I came up with. I know I'm caricaturing a little bit just to say he drove by a Tea Party rally and that's where his whole conception came from. But this idea, I mean, libertarianism is in the mainstream to a fair extent. You know, there's a libertarian position on every current event today, you know. So why is he getting this idea that people want to go back to a time before there was electricity? He's got this graphic up that's saying, I wanted to show you a picture of what society looked like the last time libertarianism would have been relevant, but the camera wasn't invented yet. Like, how many issues, like current issues, are being neglected? Issues that have to do with U.S. foreign policy or monetary policy or the police state, the drug war. You know, libertarianism has a lot to say about, a lot of really valuable things to say about those issues.
You know, yeah. As a universal, all the things you mentioned there, from foreign policy to the police state to the drug war, what were we talking about? Issues of individual liberty.
And you know, it's a shame that there's so many people today, like Steve Shives, who regard that lens of individual liberty as anachronistic. So we're going to cut it there for today. Part two of this conversation should be along by the end of the week. Thanks for listening, everyone.
I will give him power over every nation. Faith is the victory that has overcome the world. If we endure and keep the faith unto the end, we shall be saved. Faith is the victory that has overcome the world. If we endure and keep the faith unto the end, we shall be victory that has overcome the world. If we endure and keep the faith unto the end, we shall be saved. Faith is the victory.